This is Making Conversation, the Australian Composers Podcast.
Welcome to the Making Conversations Podcast. I'm Matthew Lorenzon. Today I'll be speaking with a Melbourne-based composer, May Lyon. May Lyon's work can swing from the playful to the sinister in one bar. Her interests are similarly wide-ranging. Her music is influenced by anthropology, mathematics, poetry, and even nursery rhymes. A case in point being her versory rhymes, performed here by Ensemble 21. May Lyon, thank you very much for participating in the Making Conversations podcast series. I understand that you're a little bit tired. You only got 4 hours sleep last night.
Yes.
And I want to know, what is a compositional problem that keeps you up at night?
Oh, most of them. Usually if I'm in the creation phase, I guess there'll be a melody going on in my head and I can't stop composing. So I'll step away from the computer or the piano or something and I'll still keep going. Other times it will just be, let's say, I can't finish the ending of a piece and I've tried and tried and then I'm frustrated. I've gone to bed with a project unfinished or a problem unsolved is what will keep me up at night. So, yeah, it's sort of the two ends. Hmm.
And how do you know when the problem is solved?
When it's perfect.
So there's a difference between the right sort of thing and the right thing.
Yes.
How do you know when you've found the right thing?
Some are, once again, two ways. When something needs to be given to the commissioner.
It's the right thing when the deadline comes.
Yes, that's definitely it sometimes. But also it's a timing thing. It says exactly what I need it to say. All the instruments are there. There's the right balance. It's a combination of everything. When I listen to it without looking at it, there's nothing that sort of jolts me. There's nothing that sort of takes me away from what I'm listening to. It should just all flow and make complete natural sense. And that's when I know that it's like, yep, that's everything.
Have you ever had the experience that it feels like it's jolting and then the next day you realise that you can listen to it smoothly? Or do you find that there really is a germ of something wrong in the piece that you need to fix?
I have had issues with, yes, this is awful, I don't know what I'm going to do with this tomorrow, and then I'll sit down and look at it the next day and go, oh, wow, I can use this, this and this. That's fantastic. But I will really have to scrap that other bit. I think there's also something to do with, and people have this in any job, the brain will work better at different times of the day. And so what the late night brain looks at, what the afternoon brain looks at, so you can get decision-making fatigue. And I think that is a big composer problem because the whole entire job is constant tiny decisions throughout the day. So first thing in the morning, you look at it and you think, oh, I can solve this problem. At night, it's an unsurmountable problem.
It's interesting that you're always referring to problems.
I describe myself as a problem solver.
Really?
Yes.
That's fantastic. And are these problems you've set yourself or are they problems that are presented to you throughout the compositional process?
Where
do the problems come from?
I like limits. I like working within limits. So the idea that you can do absolutely anything in contemporary music poses its own frustrations, because being able to do anything means that there are no constraints. So I like to actually make my own constraints. So a piece I recently wrote for Syzygy Ensemble, there was no D flat or C sharp within the whole piece.
That was just a pre-compositional decision?
I just decided it wasn't going to be there, and I used a serial technique. So I used just instead of 12 tone, I used 11 tone.
And was this just a decision like a George Perec writing technique that is supposed to give you new problems that you need to solve creatively?
Yes, because it meant that when I transposed into new keys, there was a limited number of transpositions I could use for the melody, because mm-hmm. the D would turn up. So all of a sudden certain chords couldn't be used, certain melodies couldn't be used. I had to fix up. Also, it added in variety, because if it did turn up, I then had to do something else there. Mm-hmm. I had to vary that little bit. So it created more problems to solve, which then naturally created a different piece.
So it actually led you away from your own habits.
Yes. Mm-hmm. I like to do that. I like to challenge myself mm-hmm. in that way. Don't like to do the same thing too many times.
That's really cool. Going back to some of your broader inspirations and background with composing, what was the first piece you ever composed?
Can I include an arrangement?
Yeah, sure.
Okay. It would have been when I was about 8, and there was a song called Bear Dance in the little book that I was learning as a child, and I made an arrangement of that piece. It was very basic. But then I think around the same age I also wrote, sort of, 1, 2, 3 in the left hand, and then a little melody in the right. And then it was all very straightforward. I didn't have the music theory to be able to write it down, but I did compose something. And yeah, I just kept going from there. I always loved writing new music.
And what do you think now, after some years of composing, you think makes your sound your own?
Eclectic, quirky, passionate. Attention to detail as well.
Was part of On the Inside by May Lyon, a work which explores the multiplicity of women's identities. It was performed last year at a concert entitled This Will Be Our Reply. It was a concert that explored the issue of violence against women. In this next part of the interview, May Lyon and I continue to discuss this issue of detail in composition, in particular, the difference between foreground and background layers within music.
I remember a few composition lessons many years ago, and sort of in seminars, and talking about that difference between background, middle ground, foreground, and really focusing on like, well, why is it the middle ground? Why is it the background? What makes it that? And it's not just the melody that makes something beautiful. It's everything else underneath. It's, you can have someone deliver a line in a movie, but it's the music. It's everything that you don't really focus on that creates the magical moment with the foreground. So to me, you have to focus on the smaller details to get that message across.
Can you give me a particular example within one of your compositions where you've really had to think carefully about these middle ground and background parts, which indeed
yes.
might not be middle ground or background after all?
My orchestral piece.
This is something you're working on now, isn't
it?
No.
This is a piece I wrote in 2014 called Orchestral Equations.
Oh, right.
Which is based on mathematics. I do that sort of thing. And there's this build up to a D where the whole orchestra plays a D at the extremities of their range. And it was too short, the lead up. It just didn't work. But to get a whole orchestra moving towards that point that works requires the right amount of delay, but it also required you couldn't have everyone just playing at the same time. So the background had to work in that there was this low sort of, I guess, I imagine it like an eel on the bottom of the sea or a river sort of crawling along, and you could hear this really dark sound slowly moving as everyone else sort of reached for the higher note. And so that element had to be there. And I think that as the background, that ended up coming out a little bit louder. But I think the passion in the strings wouldn't have worked if you didn't have the really low bassoon line and the low contrabass line.
Were there some previous ideas that you'd worked on that you had to discard?
Yes.
To try and make that climax work?
Yes. For the life of me, I can't remember what they are.
But you keep all your sketches, right? You're not just composing on a computer and throwing them, saving
over
it.
I print. I really like work on paper, and I like the red ink stage, as I call it. I print something out and I'll just get the red pen out and I'll edit everything. And I'll circle the bits that don't work. I write notes all over, like, allow flautist to breathe, don't kill flautist. Things like that. Because it's very easy to forget that they can't just hold that line forever. I will print everything out so I can actually go back and see that's exactly where I changed that. That's what I did there. But there are moments where I'll just be so focused in what I'm doing for hours and hours and changing that I won't see what I changed. There'll just be this leap from one thing to another. Suddenly, and I'm like, how did I get there? Oh, well, it works. Good.
Do you feel like you find things by accident often?
Definitely. Yes. Yes. It's the easiest way to put that one.
Since you like to work within constraints so much, if someone gave you a blank check and said that you have no time constraints, what would you do?
No time constraints.
Someone said, there are no constraints. There are no barriers. You can do whatever you want. You are actually free to pursue anything you want.
I guess there's the second opera, because I'm all going to work on the first one, and then there's the ballet, and there's the musical, and the children's opera, and then there'd be a song cycle, and
you wouldn't find
several orchestral pieces.
You wouldn't find the liberty crippling?
No. This is my passion. I'm doing it. This is wonderful. If I get to do this for the rest of my life, I'll be blissfully happy.
But you still can't pinpoint the one thing you'd do.
No, because if there's only one thing that I would want to do, then once I've done it, I might be bored. So I always have multiple options.
Okay, so I'm the commissioner, and I've said, Mayline,
devil's advocate, yes.
You are such a great composer. I just want to give you... this is a check. There's no amount filled in. You just do what you want with it, right? However many zeros you need in there. And and by the way, I don't really need to see a score, or it doesn't really matter to me when the score arrives. It might not even arrive within my lifetime, but that's fine. Here, just knock yourself out. So long as this money is used on composing one work. What's it going to be?
At this stage, I would have to say a ballet, only because I like the idea that it combines more than one art form. It also, I can have a singer in there if I wish, so there's that element. I would combine as many things as I can so that it's accessible to as many people, and I like a storyline.
You'd just be Wagner, wouldn't you? You'd actually just be Wagner.
Oh, you know what? There's a little part of me that went, I want to do the most challenging thing, and would I take that on? Yes, but not with such large forces. I think I might stick to the normal size double bass if that's possible.
No,
there is. If I can Oh, I don't know. But I like a challenge. So if someone just said, go for it, I'm like, ooh, what can I do? Yeah, and I'd think of what is the most challenging, but I don't want it to be just for me. It has to be accessible and have a point for other people as well. Otherwise, I'm writing for no one.
But at what point do you say this is accessible? A lot of the music that you write, I think, is immediately appealing. But I wouldn't say it's accessible to the broader public, because we are in our contemporary composition hole, and what we think sounds good isn't necessarily going to appeal to your average
radio listener. Preaching to the converted a little bit. Writing for other composers. I think accessible in the sense that it challenges without losing meaning. If I'm going to use an extended technique, there must be a reason for it. I don't use it just for the sake of it. I use it to express an emotion. So that's what I mean by accessible.
Expressive.
Yes. Yeah. So, the sound will be there because that's the sound that we might associate with something else that's telling a story. So even if it's, an odd story, there is something that people can follow along to. Because at some point, everyone thought some other new style of music wasn't accessible, and then it's gained acceptance.
So you are composing for the audiences of the future.
Hopefully. If not, it was wonderful navel-gazing.
You've already mentioned your interest in mathematics, but what else inspires you outside of music?
Anthropology, history, ethnomusicology, and different religions, actually. Yeah, I think they're all humanity as a whole and what makes us human, so the differences as well as the similarities.
Have you composed about particular religions or particular historical periods?
Yes, I recently did a piece called Ode to Damascus, which was representing that particular... It's the oldest, one of the oldest... continually inhabited cities in the world, about 11,000 years, I think, and it's gone through so much. It's just every war is just, oh, yes, rise and fall of another sort of, you know, great nation. Okay, sure. And so, yeah, I guess I sort of loosely composed it around that sort of the lament as opposed to the busy city. And then there was a part in there for representing water, because it was such a... It was the reason that it was built where it was. So,
what inspires you about mathematics? You said you want your music to be accessible. Mathematics isn't necessarily what people think of when they think of emotion, expression.
No.
And but somehow you're able to turn mathematics into what is some very expressive music.
Yes. Several reasons. I guess the people that study mathematics tend to be, in a way, the people that are... In the extremes of music, there's this obsession with it, highly passionate about it. They have to solve the problem. So it's a problem-solving mind. So people like Alan Turing and things that he did, I highly respect him, and composer Andrew Wiles. Mathematician Andrew Wiles.
They really are the same in your mind, aren't they?
Yes. Yeah, he solved something called Fermi's Last Theorem. So to me, people follow maths because they need to, not because they're going to earn money. And I think there's a bit of the same thing in music. And also, in a way, music is mathematics put into sound. It's just translated differently. So the whole entire world is explainable with mathematics. But it's the visual and the auditory beauty of it. So I like expressing it that way.
Do you use mathematical procedures in your compositions?
Yes, sometimes I do, yeah.
What sort of procedures?
It varies. I think I probably use them in 50% of my pieces. I have used the Sofermi's last theorem, which is x cubed plus y cubed does not equal z cubed, and for all numbers above 3 as well. And I decided on what those numbers were going to be and put those in my piece and then structured it around that. And so that's how I applied those limits that I was talking about. So the planning process was extremely long,
mm-hmm.
but once I got to the orchestration, it was very, very fast then because I had everything there.
And you find that working out the boundaries first really does help speed up the composition process
putting the notes
on the page.
Yeah, because there's rules. There's less decisions that I have to make.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't get decision fatigue, I guess. It's avoiding the decision fatigue.
We've already talked about how you feel when something is right.
Mm.
How do you know when something isn't working?
It makes me feel uncomfortable. It's because it's not all just intellectual. There is an emotional element to composing, so it's got to feel right. And writing it, it's got to feel right. And fixing it, it has to sit right. It has to say what I need it to say. And there isn't anything, I guess I can't really articulate it as beyond it has to just feel right. It's sort of a visceral thing.
Mm-hmm. Where and how do you work?
Mostly these days I work in the morning, afternoon, and in my study, which is lovely. It used to be the kitchen table. I sometimes do sit in a cafe and I will write music. That's an odd thing.
Yeah.
because there's usually music going and it's very noisy in there, but I'll write something.
Do you find that a productive space?
Yeah, I do actually. It's like having white noise in a way. That tends to be the main places, cafes and around the house. So.
And you're happy composing away from a piano or an instrument in that case?
To an extent, yes. I can usually sort of hum under my breath most of the things that I want. But there are a few things that I want to check. It depends what stage I'm at as well.
There must be a huge amount of busy work involved in composing.
Yes.
It's really not about thinking up tunes.
No.
It's so much more. And a lot of that work can be done in a cafe.
It really can. It really can.
With a coffee and a piece of cake.
It's
or two,
a
or
much
three.
More enjoyable way to do it. If I can have one of those, lovely big breakfasts with my coffee in the morning, I'm really content to do some of my work. That's really good for the red inking stage as well. You can go a little bit strange at that point because there's a lot of editing involved to get at that, into humanity, I think is a good thing.
So when a musicologist is looking at your sketches in the future, they're going to find bits of baked beans and some like butter
there
smudges.
There will be coffee stains, definitely. and there might be the occasional avocado dip.
Always need to have avocado with your eggs.
It's pretty good.
Do you believe in the idea of inspiration?
Yes.
And what does that mean to you?
An idea suddenly coming into my mind that I can't get rid of and I have to notate it down immediately.
Do you ever not get it down quick enough?
Yes.
Then it's gone?
Yes. Drives me nuts. I have actually been at a situation where luckily I was able to find a pen. I was in the middle of a concert and it was at Melbourne Recital Centre and I ended up having to actually write on my hand, and up my arm. And luckily I'm quite visual and I drew little pictures so I knew what it meant when I got home.
Was it a piece that you enjoyed or was it a piece during a piece that you didn't like so much?
No, I liked it. I guess it must have been inspiring because sometimes I will be enjoying a piece and it gets me thinking and all of a sudden I've got an idea and I went, oh, fantastic. And I'm meant to be listening.
I feel like it has to be a very special type of piece to give you a good idea. It can't be too good or too inspiring because then you're just thinking about the piece and enjoying the piece. It has to be a piece that's quite good, but leaves you enough room to think. Would you
actually
agree?
The same piece can do both. The same piece depends what mood I'm in. Depends if I've heard it before or not. Depends how tired I am. I guess. So sometimes I can listen to Bach cello sonata and I can be inspired, and other times that would just, it's exactly what I need to calm down. Mm-hmm. So they're all, yeah, it varies.
There's a certain alchemy, a chemistry between your own state of mind and the piece definitely, you're listening to.
Definitely, yeah. Yes.
Now, if you could invite any composers, living or dead, to a special dinner party at your house, who would be there and why?
Oh, dear. That's a really difficult one, actually. Because I'd want to make sure that they weren't grumpy ones that didn't speak to anybody. So assuming this is, makes it really difficult.
Apart from Bach, like, I'd invite him anyway because I just think yeah. I really want to have dinner with him, even though he'd probably be a bit of a grump.
Well, yeah, same with Beethoven. And I just think, look, you're just going to be a little bit annoying. Go sit in the corner and we'll just have dinner.
the kiddie table.
Instead of the kiddie table.
Bach and Beethoven, you guys could just sit over there. Here.
Well, I guess as well, and look, in some ways I'd love to have Mozart, but he'd probably dominate the conversation, not let anyone talk.
He would be a pain.
He would.
At a dinner party.
Yeah, so maybe not him. But assuming everyone got along... Benjamin Britten, definitely.
Yes.
Hands down.
Hands down.
Hands down. And probably Stravinsky. Because there's a few things that he does that I just really like to know why he does those things.
Yeah.
And
he'd deport himself well, I think.
Yes, I think he would. Also, Hildegard. There's a strength in that woman that she did things for different reasons, and I just want to know why. But I think more just for who she is than necessarily all of her music. But I just think she's a fascinating character. So I think I would have her for that reason as well.
And Satie, then all the food would have to be white.
Yes, that would be a bit of a problem. He could sit at that table with Beethoven. You don't play nice, you sit on the table.
We're going to have a nice conversation about theology with Hildegard.
Exactly. And I have to say, the person that I would get to do the interviews, if I was allowed to have any person to do the interviews, would be Oliver Sacks.
Oh, yes.
Because I think he could also analyse their answers if they weren't making sense, and he could probably sit at the kiddie table and get sense out of the rest.
When they invent time travel, someone needs to talk to you.
Excellent.
You're going to curate the historical dinner parties.
Excellent.
How do you support yourself financially? And how does that impact your craft? Do you have to work your craft around the need to put bread on the table?
Recently, I've been very lucky because I have a scholarship and I've had a few commissions. And, well, there's always New Start. And that just bumps you up if you don't quite make budget. So, look, I worked in corporate for years, so I think I paid taxes.
Now you get them back.
Yes, exactly. It's only a small amount, but it's still it helps. I guess while I was going through my bachelor, it was various... Yeah, I worked in a college for a few years, so I was doing tutorials and everything like that. So that was a really lovely experience. So I sort of put food on the table I didn't really put food on the table. The college did. I got provided three meals a day. That was a bit luxurious, actually. But I shared my meals with 270 students. So that's sort of been very different how I've done it every year.
So many different ways you can put food on the table
exactly.
with music.
Exactly. I've done a bit of events. About? I did a bit of event management. I've done some admin. I much prefer just straight composing. I'd love to do just more teaching. I think that's been an easier way. And, you know, every now and then, embarrassingly, Bank of Mum has had to sort of do things. But I sort of, you know, we sort of rationalise it as, you know, I moved into corporate work at the age of 19, so it's sort of most people stay at home. And
that's right. Staying at home later.
Yeah, exactly. So that's fine. You finish your bachelor. So, yes, it was... yeah, so that's Mum helped me through there. So that was a lifesaver.
So when you do receive commissions, do you feel like there's any pressure to produce a particular kind of music in order to get the money? Or do you feel like, actually, you know what, people are pretty happy to let you do what you want?
A bit of both. It depends on who's commissioning and it depends on if there's a brief. I mean, Melbourne Recital Centre, Syzygy, I kind of feel like I can do anything because they will play anything. They're very open-minded. If it's a concert where I know mine is the only contemporary piece, then, yes, I do feel a little bit more pressure. I don't want to put people off listening to contemporary music. I sort of want to be the voice of like, yes, I'm going to push your boundaries in some of these areas, but then I'm going to bring you back with a couple minutes here. And so, you know, best of both worlds.
Yeah, I wonder whether that's even a valid strategy. I kind of feel like you just need to put it out there in the most confident way possible. And that,
I write
that
what I want
speak
to write.
To people.
Yeah, yeah. I write what I want to write. It's just that I'm naturally very eclectic. I listen to very eclectic styles, and so that comes out in my music.
So it's not necessarily about changing your style to fit other people. You just naturally have an eclectic style.
Yes,
and
yes.
You do
I've
write
written,
what you want to write.
I've written a piece that's sort of like this lovely bluesy piece about Hannibal Lecter. It's a little bit of a love song to him.
Oh, my goodness.
It's really quirky. I sung it. It's a bit of a twisted, dark humour piece. And that's still my style. Hmm. It's just that that's not the style that I would normally put out there, but it suited the concert and the ensemble and what I was doing there. So, yeah, I will write according to the place and it allows me different freedoms.
What is the most memorable piece of audience feedback that you've ever had?
I did an arrangement, actually. Yeah, it was literally, I'd had a performance and an arrangement at the same one. There was a little piece I'd written called Creature. A friend danced to it. And I also did an arrangement of a Beethoven violin sonata, just the slower movement. I can't remember which one now. And Brett Dean was sitting next to me. And at the end, he came up to me and just said, "Bravo." And I don't know which piece he was talking about, but I'll take that. Thank you. Good. I'll run with that.
So if nobody heard your music, not even Brett Dean,
really?
Would you still write it?
Yes. Because no one hears your music when you start composition anyway. So half the music you write is never heard. It's one of those things. If your music is heard, that's a bonus. If you get paid for it, oh my goodness. So it's like PhD thesis. It's navel gazing. But it's you do it for your own pleasure. You do it because you have to.
What do you think Australian audiences think of when they hear new music?
What on earth is that? Honestly, I think the majority of listeners think contemporary music is Stravinsky. And that's, I've actually heard Debussy described as chainsaw music at a concert. Yes. So when they hear contemporary music, I hate to think.
Why is new music important to you?
New music is important to me because if you don't create new music, then you lose history as well.
And that's a wrap.
Oh, that was all.
That's a wrap.
Oh, okay.
Okay. Well, thank you very much for this hilarious conversation.
That's all right. If you have any more hilarious questions, you can go for it. Sorry, I shouldn't talk over you. You can try that again and I won't interrupt.
No, time. I don't know what to say. I don't think I've been given a script for how to finish this. Thank you. Thank you so much for making hilarious conversation with the Making Conversation podcast.
My pleasure. It's been lovely talking to you.
The Making Conversation podcast is brought to you by Making Waves. Making Waves is a free online listening resource bringing listeners the latest new music from Australian composers. We'd love for you to discover, listen, like, subscribe, and share new Australian music. You can find us at makingwavesnewmusic.com. We'd like to thank all the people who made this season possible. This includes the supporters of our crowdfunding campaign, project patron Cameron Lamb of Camaclan, and Creative Partnerships Australia's match funding program. The series production team is Leah Blankendahl, Stephanie Eslake, Sasha Kelly, David John Lang, Matthew Lorenzen, Rebecca Aaron-Smith, Chris Williams, Antonia Zappier, Daniel Thorpe, Thomas Green, Lisa Cheney and Peggy Polias, along with interns Angus Baxter, Marlena Radice and Mark Wolfe. The podcast theme music was the work I/O by Australian composer Elia Simic Prozik. If you wish to learn more about the composer, music or interviewer featured in this episode, head to our website and click podcast to view the show notes. If you're enjoying these podcasts from Making Waves, there are a number of ways in which you can show your support. You can subscribe to the podcast via iTunes or your favourite app. You might even like to leave a review. You can also share this episode and the series with your networks. Making Waves is a voluntary endeavour. If you're interested in volunteering or interning with us, we'd love to hear from you. We also encourage you to consider making a small one-off or continuing donation to support the ongoing promotion of new Australian music and composers. Visit makingwavesnewmusic.com/support.